simple.
Could you speak up, please? I think the microphone is okay, but if you just kind of project a little bit more, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Jeremy Newman, and I represent Edward Zimbel. This case is about fairness. The right to substitution is about ensuring a defendant's right to a fair trial, and our courts have consistently held that the statute must be applied reasonably to protect a defendant's exercise of that right. After the Court of Appeals summarily reversed Mr. Zimbel's convictions and remanded his case to the trial court for a new trial, Mr. Zimbel had a right under subsection 7 of the substitution statute to substitute Judge Atkinson. And under the unique facts in this case, Mr. Zimbel acted reasonably to assert his right to substitution, and the court erred in denying that request.
Counsel, whenever I hear unique facts, not whenever, most often when I hear the phrase unique facts, that means you're going for something narrow. Is that true here? Are you asking for a narrow holding here?
I think that is true. I mean, to a certain extent, we have asked for a narrow holding. We put forth three separate bases upon which the court could grant relief and reverse the Court of Appeals' decision. I think those arguments do go from, at least as they're presented in our brief, from narrow to at least the most broad, which I think is still a narrow, or would be a narrow holding if the court got to our third argument in this case. But if the court were to decide this case upon our first argument, that would be a very narrow holding based on the facts of this case.
Counsel, let's start with your first argument on timeliness of the request. Is it reasonable to read 97120 sub 7 as requiring something in writing?
I mean, I think if you look at the statute and you compare sub 7 to subsections 3, 4, and 5, which all deal with the right to substitution pretrial, each of those subsections have explicit written requests. Sub 7 does not. It just says a request may be made within this time.
It needs to be filed, though, correct?
Yes, it does need to be filed. And
does that not infer, at the very least, a writing?
I think that's a fair interpretation. I think the statute's somewhat unclear. For that reason, that's why we've argued, and I think the facts of this case support that he did make a written request, which was filed in the circuit court.
The written request being filed in the circuit court being what?
So he made a written request to the Court of Appeals, contesting Judge Atkinson's decision and making his intent clear that he wanted to remove the judge from his case. So that letter was not filed in the circuit court, but the Court of Appeals response letter was filed, which described Mr. Zimbel's letter as regarding substitution or recusal.
So your position is the written request for substitution was the Court of Appeals letter to the circuit court in Mr. Zimbel?
Yes, to the extent that, you know, I guess within argument number one, within that argument, that would be the written request that we're specifically talking about, and that's based on the unique facts that he did not have counsel at that time to file a written request. At the same time, he did eventually file a renewed substitution request, which referenced his initial request, referenced that writing that he made just to the wrong court.
Okay, thank you.
And he's pro se. Do we give him a little leeway because he's pro se at this time, or is he held to the same standards as a practicing lawyer?
Sure, I think that's correct. I would clarify that Mr. Zimbel wasn't pro se in the sense that he did not have a right to counsel or that he waived his right to counsel. He was entitled to counsel. He was awaiting appointment of counsel.
But he didn't have a lawyer at the time.
But he was unrepresented at the time, and he was acting on his own behalf, you know, at least for these substitution requests.
Give me the narrowest way we can decide this in your favor. Is it an equitable stance that you're taking? Is it a tolling idea? What is it? Because I'll just put it out there.
what troubles me is this works, and it's pretty clear. And you have to do it. You have to do it in writing, and you have to do it within a specific period of time, whether you're pro se or not. So if you are trying to convince me to go your way, give me your best argument.
Well, I mean, and to a certain extent, I think, depending
on how... In other words, here's my problem. I don't want it to become, oh, if you orally say something in court sometime, that should preserve it. Or if you send something to the wrong person, that should preserve it. Or if you happen to be pro se, that should preserve it. Do you see what I'm saying? We can't, in my view, that creates all sorts of trouble to open this to that kind of analysis. So help me go your way.
So to a certain extent, I think what the court can do is look at how this court and courts after that, so that would be the Baldwin court, the Clark court, and the Tesmer and Tinti courts, they all interpret the statute, and they all deal with situations where, for whatever reason, the defendant did not strictly comply with the statute. And I think the case law is very clear that the statute has to be interpreted reasonably and not strictly. When construing it strictly would interfere or unfairly deny a defendant, a criminal defendant, a right to substitution, and in some sense a right to a fair trial. So with that in mind, I think the court, with that as a background, could look at these facts and say, based on the fact that on October 7th, at his earliest possible opportunity, Mr. Zimbel made an oral request to the circuit court telling him he wanted him off the case, even if he used the wrong legal terminology. He did not have counsel at that time. Attorney Cano, who was in court with him, did not say anything about his request. He was not appointed to represent him. So Mr. Zimbel first made that oral request. He immediately thereafter, based on what the court said and did, denying the request at this time, and explicitly saying that this issue could be raised through his attorney or by his attorney by letter or at the status conference, the status hearing that was scheduled on or for October 15th.
Sounds more like an equitable or a tolling argument, and I think a reasonable construction of the statute still has to be grounded in its text, does it not?
To the extent that these facts overlap with the three different arguments we've made, I would concede that these same facts apply to the equitable tolling argument, and in that sense, the argument there is that we should toll, that this court should toll the 20-day timeline from that first date, October 7th, until counsel was appointed, and that's based on two things. First, the SPD's delay in appointing counsel to represent Mr. Zimbel, and primarily on what the court said and did about denying the request at this time and making it clear that Mr. Zimbel could raise the issue again with counsel. So Mr. Zimbel raised the issue immediately. Then he was told also by the Court of Appeals in the letter responding to his letter that he should consult with counsel, with trial counsel, about this issue. At that point, he complied with what two courts told him to do. He waited for counsel to be appointed, and he made a timely request within 17 days of that appointment.
Are you arguing that Judge Atkinson, by his words to Mr. Zimbel, was effectively tolling time periods until the status conference where he would be represented by counsel? Is that the argument that you're making?
I hadn't thought about it in terms of tolling it until that status conference, but I think that would be a fair way to think about what Judge Atkinson did and what effect the judge's words and authority would have had on Mr. Zimbel, that it wouldn't have occurred and wouldn't have been reasonable for the court to expect him to, after that October 7th hearing, to go consult the statutes as the Court of Appeals presumed he could have, looked at the sample form that can be filed to file such a request for substitution, and file a successive motion on his own without counsel. So, yeah, in that sense, equity does require and would require Obviously, we've requested the tolling to go from October 7th until the council was appointed, and that would make the November 18th filing by council, which renewed his request for substitution, timely and within the 20-day limit.
So is it kind of an interest of justice argument?
I don't know. I don't think that's how the cases that we've cited, Nichols or State X Rel Nichols and State X Rel Walker, frame it.
So what's the test? If we're going to write a test so everyone knows what it should be, what does this case teach everyone?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite.
What's the test? What's the rule that would come out of this case?
To a certain extent, I think that depends on which of the arguments the court would, I guess, base its decision on. To a certain extent, I think clarity in terms of how this statute is to be interpreted based on the case law that exists would be
helpful. Well, the statute is you have to file in writing and you have to do it within the time frame. And you're saying, yes, but. So.
Sure. Yeah, so I would say yes.
You got to help me here. How do I get to where you want me to?
So I would
other
say
than
yes.
Fairness. It's a fairness argument.
I would say yes, but. The case law, Baldwin, Clark, Tesmer, and Tinty, all make it clear that when strictly applying the statute would result in unfair consequences and deny a defendant the right to substitution, we do interpret the statute reasonably. You know, for example, in Baldwin, the court pretty explicitly rewrote the statute to mean that arraignment didn't actually occur and conclude at the arraignment. It actually concluded much later when the judge that was actually going to hear Mr. Baldwin's case appeared and had a hearing to confirm the pleas. So I think in each of these cases, our courts have been willing, if not Tesmer and Tinty courts did allow defendants who strictly construing the statute, they missed the deadlines to have their request deemed timely. So I don't think the rule from this case would actually be creating new law. It would just be affirming or reaffirming the case law that exists
no.
in terms of this statute.
Here's the case to me. The defendant has to do something under the statute in writing at a particular time if they want to substitute a judge. In the defendant's intent here is very clear. The defendant doesn't want this judge. The defendant doesn't have to give any reason, doesn't want him. Defendant does give what to the lay person is the reason, recusal or bias. And the defendant says to the judge in court on the record, you're great, but I don't want to have anything to do with you. And my lawyer says, you got to get off this case, right? Fighting the church.
Correct.
And the judge says, we won't handle it now, but we will when you get a lawyer, or words to that effect, right?
Correct.
And so the defendant says, who can I trust if I can't trust the judge? The judge told me what to do, and now we're going to do it. So the defendant gets a lawyer, and within the appropriate time limit that the lawyer is on the job, the lawyer files the appropriate paper. Is that right?
Yes.
And the judge says, too bad, so sad, too late. Now, how can that be? How can the judge say we're going to do it this way and then back off? The judge could have recused himself at any time, could have pulled out of this case with or without the appropriate papers. Right?
I think I would agree with all of that. I would say that he could have
just said,
interpreted
okay.
this as a request for substitution.
Or he could have said, you're right, I promised, I said, you obeyed, you adhered to what I said, we both screwed up, I'm out of here. Right?
I think that's essentially our equitable tolling argument. That would be, essentially that it's unfair and it's inequitable for, you know, and we've never claimed, the argument isn't that the judge intended to do anything at the first hearing, but the effect, and that's what those cases
I'm not saying that he intentionally misled the person. He didn't. He was trying to do it orderly, wait for the lawyer, get it all set up correctly. Judge probably didn't read the statute at that time, relied on his memory, right? Counsel, how can you, you're not going to argue this, but I'm going to argue for the state, how can you say that you're going to deny substitution to this defendant? I mean, it just contravenes every single thing that you want people to trust the courts and trust the judge. And when the judge screws up, he's reversed. And he screwed up here.
So are you saying the judge should have recused, or we should deem this to be a valid, timely substitution request? Those are two different things.
Yes, I agree, Your Honor. We've been very clear that while Mr. Zimbel used the word recuse, maybe for logical reason, because that's what it, you know, especially sub 7, you know, presumes possibly, or at least that idea might be out there, and to him, it seemed like something where the judge was biased. This case only deals with substitution. It's about substitution, so yes.
Counsel?
Please.
Counsel, you have three arguments that you advance, and your facts with regard at least to the second and third argument are somewhat interdependent. In response just to the previous comment, you said, well, that goes to equitable tolling. That is, that the judge instructed the defendant what to do. But it seems to me, and in reading your brief, I think it was 16 to 19, you hit this stuff, when you cited the Baldwin case, the Trinity case, the Tesmer case, and this goes to your second argument, that is that strict adherence rule should be relaxed because a government-created obstacle prevented Zimbel from timely filing his substitution motion. It seems to me that the cases that you're relying on, of course, all go to sub 4 rather than sub 7.
Sure.
They all emphasize reasonableness. Two questions. One, why should sub 7 be interpreted the same as sub 4? There are no sub 7 cases. And secondly, is there a way to live comfortably with this intersection between your second and third argument really being supported by some of the same facts? You argue that, look, that this is what the judge instructed the defendant to do. This is what you argue that this is what the Court of Appeals instructed the defendant to do when it said, contact your attorney to decide how to proceed. I'm paraphrasing, that's the last sentence in the letter. So, number one, why should 4 be the same as 7? And number two, do we just live with this overlapping? Is there any way to distinguish your second argument that it was a government-created obstacle? That, of course, came together with the difficulty in getting a public defender appointed here.
Sure. So you're correct, obviously, that there are no other cases citing sub 7. I think the obvious reason for that, and it's worth noting that this happens very rarely. This sub 7 only applies compared to subs 3, 4, and 5, at least, which apply in every case. Sub 7 only applies when a criminal defendant wins on appeal and is granted a new trial or a new sentencing. But other than that, it's about the same right. It's the right to substitution whether or not the defendant has exercised that right pre-trial. So the statute is explicit that you get one exception to the one substitution request per trial, and it's for this very reason and only in Appeals reverses the trial court and remands for a new trial or a new sentencing. And if the court looks at Holmes, which talks more somewhat more broadly about the intent of the statute and what the legislature what was trying to do when they rewrote the substitution statute, it talks about a variety of things. It talks about the right to a fair trial, which this is always about. So that applies just as well pretrial before the judge has done anything. And I think it's fair to say that it applies stronger, if you know, at least as much and possibly stronger after trial when the Court of Appeals reverses the circuit court and remands for a new trial or a new sentencing, whether or not the judge has any prejudice or bias. I think the logic of it is this is a case where at least the legislature set forth one and the only exception to the one substitution request per trial rule under the statute.
Counsel, does the trial judge have the authority to extend the deadline of 971.20?
I would cite and refer you to the cases cited, Baldwin and Clark, which don't talk about any specific statutory or otherwise authority to extend deadlines.
What about 801.15.2? When an act is required to be done at or within a specified time, the court may order the period enlarged, but only on motion for cause shown and upon just terms. Didn't he really enlarge this period by what he said to the defendant? 801.15.2. Now, there is a whole motion proceeding, et cetera. But he can do, usually they can do, judges can do motions on their own.
I wouldn't disagree. We haven't cited any specific authority, but
doesn't your position depend on the trial court's authority to extend that deadline? Because if the trial court doesn't have the authority to extend the deadline, then its actions can't affect that deadline either, can they?
Well, I would say that Baldwin and Clark and Tesmer and Tinty all say that the court erred, or you know, I guess in Baldwin and Clark that the court would have erred. I know it's my red light's on.
Please finish.
That in those cases, the Court of Appeals reversed as error the circuit court's denial of the substitution request as untimely. So I think it's a different way of looking at it, but I think what those cases say is that the court could have and should have deemed timely those substitution requests.
Well, the statute says in 801.15 is an excusable neglect statute. It cites provisions that you can't enlarge, but that's not cited. So you can't enlarge the statute of limitations, time period. You can't enlarge a time for initiating appeal under 808.04. Deciding motions after verdict under 805.16, motions for reconsideration 805.17, but this is not one of those. So you just read 801.15, he can enlarge the time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, when you were here this morning, I said Mr. Ehrman, and that's wrong. Don't tell me how I say it, attorney.
Say potato or potato.
No, that wasn't okay.
I am still Joe Eamon.
Eamon. Thank you. I will remember the next time I see you, which I probably will.
Thank you
for helping me out. Yes. Please begin.
I'm Joe Eamon, and I'm again appearing on behalf of the State Public Defender, Kelly Thompson. The Public Defender asked for permission to weigh in this case because the Attorney General's argument evinces a misunderstanding regarding scope of representation and statutory and administrative rules which govern scope of representation in public defender cases.
Mr. Eamon, how are we to tell whether Attorney whether he was representing Mr. Zimbel at the time he was in court?
There's no order appointing counsel issued in the case. He files those with the circuit court. He was there in an administrative capacity.
Is there anything on the record to reflect that?
He explained that, I believe. In the record. He was not advocate counsel there. I also want to provide some information regarding obstacles or barriers that exist as one case, a case moves from one level to the next, one case ends and another begins. Regarding scope of representation, the AG argues that either Eileen Hirsch, who is Mr. Zimbel's appointed appellate attorney, or the local attorney manager should have been responsible for filing what was in essence a post-appeal pre-trial motion for substitution. Neither was responsible. And this isn't just a matter of sort of historical practice or internal operating procedures. By statute and administrative code rule, an appellate case is considered a separate case in the public defender world. Eligibility is determined as a case moves from one level to the next. A new order appointing counsel is issued. A new fee is imposed on the client. And certification requirements for people to handle each type of case are different. You have to be certified, private bar attorneys have to be certified for case types before they can provide representation in those cases. The scope of an appellate appointment extends through completion of the case in state court. The appellate attorney does post-conviction, court of appeals through state Supreme Court, and that's it. And at the end of the case, when it's done, when there's no petition for review filed, the scope of representation ends when the lawyer advises the client of that and makes arrangements for new counsel to be appointed. And that's what Eileen Hirsch did, and that's why, and that is when Jeff Cano got involved. And sure, I mean, as an officer of the court, I guess, you know, Eileen Hirsch was an attorney. She legally could have filed this motion, but she is not representing the client. She's not responsible for that. That just makes no sense. That is a decision to substitute judge is a decision that needs to be made between the attorney and his client at the trial level with local knowledge. It just isn't the appellate attorney's responsibility.
Counsel, on page 14 of the state's brief, it reads thusly. Had Zimbel informed Attorney Cano or Attorney Hirsch that he wanted to request a substitution of judge, it would have been incumbent on them to file the simple suggested form. In the alternative, their failure to act on Zimbel's desire to substitute judges would have constituted ineffective assistance of counsel. If it's ineffective assistance of counsel, what's the remedy here?
Well, first, neither one was counsel for Mr. Zimbel, so you can't be ineffective when you are not representing somebody. But had an attorney blown this deadline and was ineffective, yeah, I guess that the remedy could be.
A new trial.
A new trial, yeah.
What about ineffective judge?
Well, we don't...
That's for you.
We don't weigh in on that. But I want to talk a minute about barriers. So, as an incarcerated client, when a case moves from the Court of Appeals back to the Circuit Court with a new trial, eligibility has to be redetermined. Typically, that requires the defendant to be returned to the local jurisdiction so they can do that. We don't have instant access to people in the prisons. You can't just pick the phone and call a client. It would make no sense to mail an eligibility form because chances are they're going to cross in the mail. So you wait till the defendant's back, determine eligibility. Also, you know, I want to point out that this wasn't a conflict case, so in theory could have been assigned to a staff attorney, but with caseload, staff attorneys are not always available to take cases on short notice. And so we have the private bar, with some private bar attorneys. But I want to emphasize, too, how fragile our private bar attorney list is in some areas. In some areas of the state, we don't have any attorneys, or just handfuls of them, and we rely on their willingness to take cases. And had this been a conflict case, it would have been required to go out to a private bar attorney. So these obstacles eat into that 20-day deadline. And like I said, this hasn't come up very often because it just doesn't happen that often at the Court of Appeals grants new trials.
How many per year?
Excuse me?
How many times in a year will one of your clients get a new trial from a court of appeal? Do you know?
It happens more often at the post-conviction stage, but it's fewer than scores of times. It's tens of times per year. It's not that often. And I concede, you know, we can do better to try and move these cases up in the queue, but there will be times when it will be impossible to get a public defender appointed within this deadline. And what makes the most sense to me, and in the worst case scenario, becomes it's 20 days from the date new counsel is appointed. And like I said, it's not very many cases, and it's not a big burden that will not delay or cause, you know, problems with people raising this months into the into the term.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Preparing for today's or this afternoon's argument, I listened to one this morning, and Mr. Eamon appeared there too. And I assume the court remembers his remarks, or at least some of them. I wrote a few of them down. They were playing in the background as I reviewed my materials, and they included, we're never going to leave a client alone in court. And I think he ended his remarks with and commenting that our job's hard, yeah, but we do it. We don't think anyone should have to stand alone in court. My concern is that his position here today, not on behalf of Mr. Zimbel, certainly individual public defenders may take inconsistent positions on behalf of their clients. He's here on behalf of the same institution. And what I hear him saying is, Mr. Zimbel was without counsel. He was out to dry.
Well, counsel, that's a very different circumstance. The case this morning, as you know, there were three counsel that were substituted out. His remarks were made in response to a question from the court or a statement by the court, three strikes and you're out. And he said, we don't have that rule. And I think he was trying to explain that they would try to appoint a fourth counsel. That doesn't mean they can pop up and they can be in court the next day or the day after that, but I don't see any comparison.
Well, and maybe not the day, or if, I guess the corollary, the comparison I would make, were this an initial appearance for Mr. Zimbel, his attorney would have been there despite a far more severe time constraint. And I am troubled that, appreciating the practicality of what that office deals with, I understand full well that they have difficulties sometimes clearing conflicts and financial eligibility. I don't think that was an issue for Mr. Zimbel because he had been a client for so long, and having been in prison, unlikely to have changed in terms of his financial position. That said, the administrator who showed up twice, I think it's a little, I'm troubled that he says, I wasn't there in any capacity at all, even to preserve Mr. Zimbel's right to substitution.
I was a little concerned, counsel, about the argument that I read, in part, and that is on page 14 of your brief.
Yes.
Where, in essence, you say, if either attorney Hirsch or Kano knew that the defendant wanted to substitute on the judge and they didn't file a simple substitution request, then that constitutes ineffective assistance of counsel. I read that and I went, woo, that's exactly what I did. Because I don't see that kind of assertion very often, number one, in a brief from the state. And number two, the facts of this case are that October 7th, the defendant discussed with, I'll be more precise, the facts are that on October 7th, the defendant reported to the court that he had discussed with attorney Hirsch his desire to have a substitution request. So it seems to me, if that fact, as he reported to the court, is accurate on October 7th, then you take the position that that constitutes ineffective assistance of counsel. The danger is that all these cases will get new trial. You really want to push that?
Well, and thinking about that further, I think it's better stated to say, I think something else could have and should have happened. There were other questions and remarks from counsel. Mr. Zimbel undoubtedly had a right to counsel. We just didn't have one there. We just didn't have someone ready to go that day. Justice Kelly asked whether the court might have the ability, and Justice Abrahamson chimed in, whether the court is able to extend the deadline for requesting substitution. I think it can. So is it beyond the realm to think that even in an administrative capacity, someone from the public defender's office, knowing they will appoint counsel, could come in and meet with Mr. Zimbel and say, Mr. Zimbel, I'm not here, I'm not on your behalf going forward for trial, but I do want to discuss with you one limited thing that I'd like to do on your behalf in court today. I'd like to go in and ask that any of the applicable deadlines, including this one, don't even have to be that specific, be stayed until that appointment is made and you can meet with your appointed
counsel. Why shouldn't we interpret the November 18th letter of counsel that was filed requesting substitution as a request for a reconsideration of the court's initial decision made October 7th?
The court's initial decision, I have a little bit of a problem there. I don't know that they were talking about substitution, but more important, remitter hadn't happened. I don't think the court could have ordered substitution on October 7th.
If we talk about timing a little bit, when I'm going through the court record of CCAP, it looks like on the 11th, this was remanded, right? October 11th, the 18th. October, I'm just looking at the CCAP record. October 8th, 22, it looks like there's a letter to Attorney Zimbel from
That's
the court.
Diane Fremden's letter. Responding to his
from
letter
the Court of Appeals. 47. And then on the 22nd is the order appointing counsel.
No,
so,
Annette, I don't think those are.
Well, I'm just looking at the CCAP records. So
I looked at the same one, and that's accurate.
Okay.
I don't
and
think we have a full record as to what.
But it's sort of interesting to me. I mean, I'm just trying to reconcile this, because what I hear people saying, and when you look at this, you sort of feel like, okay, this guy really asked for a new judge. How come he didn't get one? But he didn't really do it right under the statute. So how do you reconcile those things? And then he gets a lawyer on the 22nd when the case had come back, it looks like on the 11th. Mm-hmm. So you've got... You still have time within the 20 days for filing, but that would have been, right, the 31st or the 1st of November, depending on how that's counted, right? And then they have the status conference on the 1st of November, but it's not before Judge Atkinson. It's before Judge Hinkfuss, according to the court records. So maybe they went there thinking, we don't have Atkinson. We have Hinkfuss. To me, that might play a role in this. No? How do you help me with that or not?
I am looking for the...
Because, you know, he goes there and presumably that's about the last day he can file this request, and he's going to court, and at least according to this court record, Judge Hinkfuss is the judge presiding over the matter, not Atkinson.
And that was on which date? I'm sorry.
11-1, the status conference. Which presumably is the day that Atkinson said, hey, come back with your lawyer on November 1.
I wish I had the actual court transcript. I mean, sometimes, I hate to say this, but I don't always trust CCAP. I didn't notice that Hinkfuss was listed in the CCAP entry as the judge on that date.
Counsel, would you
counsel, did you have that transcript?
Counsel, would you take a look if you have it easily available? Your opposing counsel's brief, and I want to point to page 10. I assume you're familiar with that chart and those dates.
Yes.
Those dates are very different than the dates that were just read from CCAP. Which dates do you think are correct? Which dates have you been relying on and the Court of Appeals' opinion relying on?
Well, I think...
You were in the Court of Appeals. You briefed this.
No, I understand. I went from the actual court record to the extent I had transcripts and the actual court docket of appearances and when they occurred. And, again, if we had that available, we'd check to see that and provide certifications who actually presided over the November 1st date.
It's a surprise to me to hear the dates that were just read. because I have viewed this case as I read the Court of Appeals opinion, the recitation of the facts, I read the briefs and the recitation of the facts, and they all comport with this chart on page 10. So you tell me, is this chart on page 10 correct on dates or incorrect, if you know?
I don't believe it's inaccurate. It may be incomplete to the extent it doesn't include these additional dates.
No, but different dates were given. I mean, is it your position that remittiture occurred on October 8th?
Yes.
Is it your position that the letter from the Court of Appeals was on October 22nd? I think that's what she did say. Is that right?
The letter from the Court of Appeals? Yes,
that's
right. That's accurate.
And that a status hearing was on October 29th?
Yes.
That right? And that the chart reflects a status hearing on October 7th also?
Yes.
Are those dates consistent with what you recall?
Yes. Yes. I think Justice Ziegler was referencing, there is listed in the CCAP printout an order appointing counsel that is this, and that's not reflected in the time.
No. It says October 11, remitter from the Court of Appeals.
And they all say October 8th in that, in all of their briefings.
No, but I'm just
and
going
the
to the record and
didn't you
at
also
the
say,
record.
Didn't you also say, Justice Ziegler, there was an order appointing counsel dated October 22nd?
And that's...
That was
no,
the
no,
letter
from...
the order appointing counsel is 11-1.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right.
And no, I understood
according
that.
According to this.
And there is another one.
But that's the same day it looks like they appeared in front of Judge Hinkless.
Okay. And that I don't have confirmation of for the November 1st date. I have them in front of Justice Atkin.
Those dates don't really matter. If you're looking at remitter, whether it was the 8th or the 11th,
agreed.
If you interpret things dryly, it was too late.
Agreed.
Let's take a look, and I want to follow up, if I may, on a question. Let's take a look at the statutes. God, love these statutes. And the first position of your opposing counsel was, number one, that it was timely. Don't have to enlarge the time. It was timely. Contrary to the Court of Appeals opinion, it suggested that the oral request at the October 7th hearing was timely. And I thought that was wrong. Is it your position that the October 7th oral request is untimely?
Well, I think it's premature. I also think it's insufficient because it was neither in writing nor filed with the court.
Okay. So let's go to filed with the court in sub 7 and the statute. Unlike sub 3 and sub 4 and sub 5 that give explicit reference to written request filed with the clerk. 7 is a little different, so it needs interpreting, and I think Justice Kelly referenced this, but it does say this. It says, if an appellate court orders a new trial or sentencing proceeding, a request under this section may be filed within 20 days. I think a reasonable interpretation, if you're going to file something, it has to be some paper or something.
I agree with you.
After the filing of
the e-filing.
That's right. I'm talking about backward, turn backward, or time in its flight. When this case occurred, we didn't have e-filing here. A request under this section may be filed within 20 days after the filing of the remittiture. So, sub 10 says, here's a form you can use. A request for substitution of a judge may be made in the following form. And it's kind of interesting because the form is ever so brief, unlike the prior affidavit of prejudice that used to have to be filed with substitution. All you have to say is, I want a new judge, in essence.
Yeah.
This form is not required. It's just a maybe. So it has to be in writing, we know, in sub 7, not because it says in writing, like it does in 3, 4, and 5, but because it has to be filed. But point well taken on electronic filing. So it has to be filed. So it has to be in writing. So here, the argument of your opposing counsel was it was filed. And it was filed within 20 days of remittiture. I'll use October 8th. We'll see if that's right or not. October 8th was the date of remittiture. It was filed with the clerk of circuit court, received on October 15th, stamped, and that's what the record reflects, so that's within the 20 days. October 22nd, then, the clerk of circuit court sent a letter to the defendant that in essence said, we have your request for substitution and or recusal. We no longer have jurisdiction. We sent it back. Contact your attorney for further advice how to proceed. It was three sentences, I think, maybe four. And then they sent it to the circuit court judge and the clerk of circuit court. Why isn't that, as your opposing counsel argues, being filed? There's no specific form. You don't have to give a reason. The request is filed. That's their argument. It's timely and it's filed. That's their first argument.
I don't think the Court of Appeals letter noting Mr. Zimbel's letter to that court sent out, it can be construed fairly as Mr. Zimbel's written request properly filed for substitution.
Why not? And maybe it can't be, but I want you to elaborate on that. I think it has two prongs. Number one was his filing with the Court of Appeals, and clearly the letter to the judges or justices there, as he says, made it real clear that he did not want this judge on the case and asked for a different judge and implored their help. So that arguably could be a filing. But also the letter that was sent by the clerk to Judge Atkinson and the clerk of circuit court. And there's no required form. Why couldn't that be construed as timely? It's filed. It's a request for substitution. Certainly it alerted the court that there was a request for substitution.
Well, I think it's a letter from the Court of Appeals acknowledging, look, hey, we don't have jurisdiction anymore to entertain the request you sent to us, not the circuit court, but then to suggest that the Court of Appeals correspondence, and they're not clear on what it is. They write, we're writing in reference to Mr. Zimbel's request for recusal slash substitution. They're not even clear on exactly how to interpret it, to suggest that that's a filing on his behalf to make a substantive request to exercise his right to substitute counsel. I just don't think that's appropriate.
Ms. Noah, the right to request substitution of the judge, is that a significant right belonging to the defendant for a fair trial?
Significant, I realize that term can be subject to some debate. I don't know if you're getting at something more specific. I think it was certainly significant enough such that Mr. Zimbel had a right to counsel. I think we all agree on that.
Okay, so that's what I'm getting to. So let's assume that Mr. Zimbel was not represented by counsel between remittiture and November 1st. If the time period within which to request substitution of the judge elapses during that period through no fault of Mr. Zimbel, has he not been deprived of the assistance of counsel with respect to a significant trial right?
My position is, and that's kind of where my initial remarks were going, yes. I mean, I think arguably he might well have a valid claim. For instance, if you want to flip that, let's say Mr. Cano showed up in his administrative capacity at one of these two hearings he attended, and for whatever reason, Mr. Zimbel began making statements incriminating himself, perhaps threatened the judge that he was upset with. How would any of us in the room feel were eventually a claim made that Mr. Cano ought to have said something, at least instructed him to keep his mouth shut? How would any of us feel if either the state or the public defender's office stepped up and said, oh, hey, hold on a minute, he didn't have representation at that hearing?
Well,
there's no ineffective assistance of counsel claim. So I agree with you that
he may
have one.
Yeah, I'm not doing ineffective assistance of counsel right now. I'm doing lack of counsel. All right, so let's assume that he was not represented by anyone between remittiture and November 1st. If we allow that time period to expire to substitute judge, during that period of time, without him being represented by counsel, has he not been deprived of the Sixth Amendment right to assistance of counsel?
If we allow it to expire, I don't know who's getting blamed for that.
The statutes.
The statutes?
Good.
Yeah, they're big. They can
yeah, that's right. Yeah. They don't take
the
it personally.
Statute. Understand.
So has he been deprived of the right of counsel?
In this case?
Yes.
I think it's clearly my position. He ought to have had an attorney in limited scope or otherwise appointed to him to timely, on time,
okay.
To make
so
sure
answer,
that right was preserved, yes.
So the answer is yes.
Yeah.
If that period of time expires before he's appointed counsel, then he has been deprived of the right to counsel.
I hope. By government related operations.
No, I don't know. I mean, the baton had to be passed from appellate counsel back to trial counsel. There was a letter.
Maybe they fumbled.
But,
right?
But I guess if you have to blame someone, I mean, you know, look, this is the problem here.
We don't have to blame anyone.
Sure.
I mean, let's just keep the focus on the statute and its relationship to the Constitution under circumstances like this. So whether or not there ought to be a different procedure in place for the SPD to hand off representation from appellate counsel to trial counsel upon going back to circuit court, that's a good question for the SPD to consider. For us, though, what we have to figure out is, were any of his rights lost inappropriately, right?
Well, and you know, I share with the court the concern over this particular circumstance. That said, in looking at the case law and the statute that applies, it says 20 days from remitter. Those cases that discuss a reasonable interpretation that would afford an extension of that time limit universally deal with cases where a defendant doesn't have appropriate notice of who his judge is going to be to fill out that simple form. All of them deal with that.
Yeah, so let's pick up on that. So that deals with a lack of facts available to the defendant, right? And in those circumstances, we say, well, look, we can't ask him to make an intelligent decision when he doesn't have the facts to inform him, right? That's basically the rationale for those cases, correct?
We can't ask someone to make a decision about substituting against a judge who has not been identified to him
right.
or her.
So here we have a circumstance in which we are asking him to exercise a right that he doesn't know how to exercise, right? And under circumstances...
Potentially. We don't know that.
Well, under circumstances in which we presume that he doesn't know, that he knows how to exercise that right. That's pretty much why we have the literature we do on the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, is we presume they don't know how to protect their rights. Isn't that true?
Well, I suppose that's perhaps the foundation, and yet, despite the fact that we all acknowledge lay people probably aren't very good at representing themselves, they have a right to do it.
They do. So if he had exercised his right to represent himself, that would be an entirely different circumstance. But here, there's nothing in the record to suggest he wanted anything other than immediate appointment of counsel, right?
Yeah, I agree.
Okay.
So
if he wants appointment of counsel, and he's essentially telling us by that is, I need legal help to protect my rights. Now, isn't that exactly the kind of circumstance that our Sixth Amendment jurisprudence says, yes, he needs counsel, and he must not lose any of his rights when he doesn't have counsel?
Well, but then what is the remedy, and then where do we analyze it? Are we under the rubric of ineffective assistance of counsel, or are we elsewhere?
I think you tell me. I mean, I don't know that it would be ineffective assistance of counsel because he had none under this hypothetical, at least. Right? So what would the AG say to this circumstance? How would the AG approach the defendant's right when he's not represented and there's a clock ticking?
Well, if someone truly is not represented and there's a clock ticking, you know, there are a variety of circumstances where that could happen. If Mr. Zimbel were not eligible,
couldn't we just toll the statute until counsel was appointed? I mean, clearly he wanted counsel. It wasn't his fault he didn't have it. Probably wasn't anybody's fault he didn't have it. From what I heard at judicial conference, there are unfortunately many times when people appear in court and the public defender's office has tried to get them counsel and they cannot.
Sure.
So what about if we toll it from the 1st of November until, toll it until the 1st of November, that's when counsel was appointed, and then counsel's letter asking for substitution on the 18th is within 20 days, and it's time. How about that?
My concern with the tolling argument is that as much as it might feel appropriate under as opposing counsel called it, the unique facts of this case, there are many others where it could be terribly problematic.
Okay.
And how would it be problematic?
For instance, take a person who does not qualify for public defender representation and perhaps has every intent in the world, and there's been much debate about the substitution statute and the potential abuses of that statute. If that defendant's delay in retaining counsel allows him to go beyond those 20 days and sit around and see what happens, that can go on for an awfully long time. Then it is disruptive.
Sure.
Court system, it's problematic for the victims in the case.
Yeah, and so in those circumstances, as you listen to the arguments from this morning, could we say under those circumstances that maybe you waived by conduct your right to counsel, or you forfeited your right to counsel? Isn't it generally the rule that so long as a person is entitled to representation, you don't allow the case to proceed until he has that representation?
A finding of waiver of counsel appropriately done typically comes pretty far down the road, certainly well beyond 20 days into a case. And so, again, there's disruption, there's delay that's unwarranted, and provided that finding is acceptable, at that point, isn't the defendant still going to say, oh, but, you gave me that amount of time, now I'm going to substitute? That's the problem.
Counsel, I hear Goldilocks, and that's this. The third argument about tolling is too hard. The first argument about it is timely filed is too soft. You know, in other words, I'm just saying neither of those are arguments that you like. Let's see if we can find one that's just right for the state. If the court were going to decide in the defendant's favor, which argument is most palatable to the state? Is it the second argument that the strict adherence rule should be relaxed because government created obstacles prevented Zimbel from timely filing the substitution motion?
You know, I'm always leery when I'm put on the other side of a case.
I know, but you'll hear some
but
of the questions.
But in that spirit, were the court looking for the narrowest ground on which to rule in Mr. Zimbel's favor? I suppose you could say the trial court erred and forgot or overlooked its own extension of the deadline. Mm-hmm. So you'd be error correcting on this case. I think the trial court can extend that deadline.
But you have to extend it for good cause under 801.14(2).
Sure. There was
a
discussion of
that.
Appointment of counsel.
Yeah.
Say the judge screwed up, as Justice Abrahamson said earlier. Mm-hmm. Not my words, yours.
Nor mine.
That I suppose would be the narrowest ground. And in lieu of an equitable tolling ruling that I think would be horribly problematic, I suppose that would be more palatable to the state.
The cases cited for equitable tolling are all of the prisoner cases.
Yes.
As I recall, but correct me if I'm wrong. The Walker case, the Schmelzer case, Nichols are all prisoner kind of, the prison mailbox isn't working right. I'm loosely speaking now.
Right.
So I don't know of any case on tolling that was cited that is other than a prisoner getting the mail out case.
I believe you're right about that.
See, in this case, I'm not convinced. I'm going to check more than we have here in this box, but the way this record looks, the 11th was the date of remitter. They would then have till the 31st of October. In the meantime, you have him coming in saying, Judge, I want somebody new. The judge says, let's wait till you come back with your lawyer at a status. There is a status date set for the 29th, which would have been before the 31st. And then no lawyer was there on the 29th, and the judge pushed it off to the 1st. And when they pushed it off to the 1st, according to the court record, there was a different judge there. So, I mean, I need to double-check those things, but it strikes me that if the defense were going to argue something, that would be... It has to be somewhat in the range of reasonable, isn't it?
Well, I'd have to look at that too, and I apologize for not having.
Because otherwise, the dates don't line up with what the court said it would do. That is, hey, you can make this request when you come back at the status, and if the record is right and it's the 11th, he'd have till the 31st. The status was set for the 29th. The judge pushed it off to the 1st. Which happens to be a day beyond.
Oh, there was a status conference on the 29th.
But with no lawyer. He wanted his bond heard. He wanted some other things. I read it.
Right. That's right.
But they did not address the thing the judge told them they would be addressing at status when a lawyer was present.
That's right.
Okay. So the dates are important, is what I'm saying.
Of course they are. Absolutely, in a case like this. I see my red light.
No, that's why I have Kevin getting them. Some are the 29th, not the 1st. This is going to move.
Mr. Eamon, Mr. Newman, Mr. Eamon said that Attorney Cano indicated he appeared in an administrative capacity. Is that anywhere in the appendices?
I couldn't quite hear the question, but I think you were asking where in the record is the authority or the basis for Mr. Cano to have only been there in his administrative capacity?
Correct.
I would... So I think the court can look at the records from those October 4th and October 7th hearings to clarify, even though Mr. Cano was there, he was there to set up the appointment of counsel. But I think what he says is that you need to set up a status hearing so that counsel can be appointed, and that only when Mr. Zimbel would come back to Brown County would the SPD's office discuss with him the appointment of counsel. So to answer your question directly, I don't think there's anything in the record to cite to for that he was there explicitly in his administrative capacity, but I think what he says to the court and the discussion that the court had with Attorney Cano makes it clear that he was not representing Mr. Zimbel. He would not be representing Mr. Zimbel at trial. There was going to be a new attorney appointed, and they set off the status hearing so that could happen. The expectation would have been, or seems to have been, that he would have had counsel at the October 15th hearing. He didn't. The state, from that transcript at that hearing, the state failed to prepare the writ to have him brought back to Brown County. That's why there was the delay in getting him to Brown County. That's why the hearing was set off until the 29th. At the 29th, Mr. Zimbel appears on his own without counsel. Judge Atkinson explains, and it seems like he got a call from the public defender's office during the hearing saying that, oh, wait, they're requesting additional time.
That's the October 29th transcript you're referring
yes.
to?
Yes. That they were requesting additional time because the office had not been able to find an attorney to take the case. So to clarify... Because there's been questions about the narrowest rule and what we're asking this court to hold. I'll admit that the facts in this case overlap with the different theories. same facts apply to each legal argument, and if the court were to interpret one of the arguments more fitting of these facts and more narrow, I, Mr. Zimbel, would have no objection to a tweaking of the way we've set forth the arguments. But I mean, I think argument two could be a sort of a good happy medium between applying the equitable tolling rule, which I'll admit that it hasn't been applied to the substitution statute for sure, but I don't think it's a stretch to apply that rule to this case. Mr. Zimbel was an unrepresented, or he was a defendant, criminal defendant without counsel. He was in prison and or in jail for this entire period of time. So while we haven't claimed any specific burden that was placed on him by the prison or by the jail, he was similarly situated.
If you're looking for an error, we'll be wrong with Ms. Nowitz somewhat reluctantly produced, however, in arguing.
It was knowing but not voluntary.
Inarguably narrow rule applicable to the facts of this case. What would be wrong with what she ultimately came out with?
I don't know if I recall exactly what her rule was or what she conceded
to. You're happy, right?
Yes, obviously. And, I mean, I think that's the way we've set forth the brief. You know, I think my position is that argument number one is the very narrowest holding. It applies these facts, and I think they are unique, these facts to the law, but it doesn't require the court to deem timely the November 18th filing. It just treats these facts and says, yes, under all of these circumstances, which are rare, and it would, you know, I don't know how that would be applied in future cases, but...
It would be applied in a case where the judge instructs the individual.
It would be very narrow. And going one step further, my red light's on.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you both for very good arguments today. It's always hard, counsel, when we put you in the position of, now, if you were on the other side, what would you do? We recognize that.